Buenos días a todos. Quiero comenzar diciendo unas brevísimas palabras en honor, digamos, a tres personas. En primer lugar, aunque no sea el homenajeado, me va a permitir que le pase en primer lugar a Jordi Ferrer. Jordi, muchas gracias, muchas gracias. Este congreso, anoche lo comentaba con otra persona, este congreso es probablemente lo mejor que he visto en organización de congresos, tanto en cuanto a la sala como en cuanto a la estructura del congreso, los ponentes que has traído, que es lo mejor que hay en el mundo en materia de epistemología, como también en cuanto a que hayas dejado unos amplios espacios de debate, de discusión. Es verdaderamente lo que se tiene que convertir en un congreso, en un intercambio de ideas, con lo cual, de verdad, una y mil veces gracias. Y también gracias por haber pensado en mí para presentar nada menos que a Larry Laudan, a quien después también le dedicaré unas palabras. En cuanto al homenajeado, Michele, yo la verdad es que, bueno, no está bien hablar de uno mismo cuando intenta homenajear a una persona y, por supuesto, no lo voy a hacer, pero sí que tengo una relación pues, con Michele, científica, en parte personal también, que verdaderamente me ha hecho sentir muy próximo a él muchas veces, tanto en caracterialmente como científicamente. Michele es una persona que yo descubrí porque en sus estudios siempre le dedicaba un apartado a la historia. Siempre. Tenía un gusto por la historia que no era frecuente en los procesalistas. El procesalista siempre dice que no, que la historia que la hagan los historiadores, pero y los procesalistas nos dedicamos al proceso. Yo siempre pensé que eso era falso. Y de repente encontré pues, a una persona que no solamente se dedicaba a la historia, sino que además lo combinaba con el derecho comparado de una forma inteligente, es decir, no se iba a buscar el derecho de Camboya y el derecho de sitios remotos, sino que realmente aprovechaba el derecho comparado para lo que era realmente útil, para el discurso que tenía que hacer, ¿no? Lo cual, pues evidentemente, daba a luz pues, una obra vastísima, que todos ustedes conocen, una obra enorme, enorme verdaderamente, en la cual todos nos hemos inspirado. Y que a mí, pues, desde luego me ha servido de muchísima inspiración para escribir cosas sobre la casación y sobre la prueba. Pero al margen de esto, yo querría destacar que Michele es sobre todo un jurista con una franqueza, con una sinceridad tremenda. Una vez, no hace mucho, un amigo común me dijo, Michele es duro, es una persona dura. Digo, mira, no es... No, sí, vamos a ver, más que una persona dura, es una persona clara. O sea, al menos no es de esas típicas personas que nunca sabes si se han enfadado o no se han enfadado. Si se han enfadado, te lo va a decir. Pero no vas a estar pensando en, ay, igual esto le ha caído mal, igual esto... No, no, él te lo va a decir directamente, ¿no? Y si cree que lo que dices es estúpido, te va a decir que es estúpido. Y tú lo tienes que aceptar y a mí me gusta realmente pues, que siempre me haya tratado pues, de esta forma, tanto cuando me ha elogiado como cuando no le ha gustado algo y espero pues, que lo sigas haciendo siempre igual. Gracias, Michele, por tu ayuda. Y bien, y ahora me toca presentar a Larry Laudan. Créanme ustedes que la verdad es que tiene uno la sensación de estar al lado de Karl Popper o de alguien así. Es decir, estamos al lado de uno de los epistemólogos más importantes del siglo XX y, teniendo en cuenta que goza de buena salud también, del siglo XXI. Es una persona que yo como procesalista, teóricamente, nunca hubiera tenido que conocer si no hubiera sido pues, gracias a Jordi y a Michele, que nos han traído las obras de los epistemólogos también a los procesalistas. Y así es como yo llego algunos de los libros de Larry Laudan, pero en especial al Truth, Error and Criminal Law, que es un libro que verdaderamente me impresiona porque bueno, trata del estándar de la duda razonable. Y por fin se centra en ver qué es razonable para la Corte Suprema de los Estados Unidos. Y claro, y acaba llegando a la conclusión de que no tiene un concepto de lo que es razonable. Y luego él hace otra reelaboración. Me encantó esa conclusión. Me encantó. Sobre todo porque hace ya algún tiempo que bueno, a pesar de que esto pues lo hemos hablado y no tenemos ninguna apuesta al respecto. Ustedes saben, lo dijo ayer Miquel Etarufo, que Jordi Ferré y él están escribiendo un libro sobre estándares de prueba. Y estoy seguro, seguro, que uno de ellos es la presunción de inocencia o la duda razonable. Estoy seguro. Yo no voy a hacer aquella apuesta que hicieron en 1975 Kip Thorne y Stephen Hawking sobre la existencia de los agujeros negros, según la cual Stephen Hawking decía que existían los agujeros negros y Kip Thorne decía que no existían. Y se jugaron una suscripción de un año a la revista Penthouse. Suscripción que todavía no ha ganado nadie, pero que Stephen Hawking dijo, si pierdo, al menos podré disfrutar del Private Eye. Bueno, yo no he hecho ninguna apuesta. Yo, y Michele lo sabe, creo que el estándar de la duda razonable en realidad no es ningún estándar. Me parece que algo que viene de una instrucción de jurados del siglo XVII aproximadamente, que además está basado en una idea de Ulpiano y luego mezclado pues con algo que quizás sí que es un estándar, que es lo de la certeza moral del derecho canónico, me cuesta pensar que verdaderamente pueda llegar a ser un estándar de prueba. Pero estoy dispuesto a equivocarme, por supuesto, con lo cual estoy deseando ver la publicación de vuestro libro y estoy deseando también escuchar a Larry Laudan al efecto, porque yo cuando escribí La duda razonable nunca me pude imaginar que un día estaríais los tres reunidos y realmente podríais ilustrarme sobre esta materia y sobre otras muchas. Con lo cual, Larry Laudan, es un placer estar presentándole. Bien, cuando quiera, pues adelante. Muchas gracias.
Thank you very much for the introduction, Jordi. It will be a relief to all of you, I'm sure, if I tell you at the beginning that my paper is going to be much less pompous and much less wordy than the title of the paper. I apologize for that. It's a great pleasure to be back in Girona again and among many of the legal epistemologists that I most admire and enjoy interacting with. Above all, it's a pleasure to be participating in an event that honors Michele Etarufo, whose splendid book some years ago gave me hope there might be scope for bringing to the law some of the same epistemic concerns that drove my earlier work in the philosophy of science. I can think of no book in the history of recent legal theory that is as savvy about current themes in the philosophy of science and their bearing on the law as Michele's La prueba de los hechos. Translated from the Italian, of course, by our host, Jordi Ferrer. How many other legal theorists talk knowledgeably about abduction, verisimilitude, Bayesian probabilities? Who else exhibits a subtle grasp of the theories of Popper, Carnap, or Quine? I hope and trust that his retirement from teaching does not imply his withdrawal from research, since that would be a significant loss for the field. Ever since I began writing about the epistemology of law a decade ago, one of my favorite themes has been that the standard of proof, whether you look in the common law or in the Roman or civil law, that standard is profoundly ill-defined and ill-conceived. No matter what country we look to, what we find is a barely specified and ill-defined cutoff point for distinguishing whom is to be judged guilty and whom is to be found not guilty. Whether we call it proof beyond a reasonable doubt, prueba plena, sana critica, proof más allá de cualquier duda, being sure, that's the New England, the English standard, right? It leaves enormous room for ambiguity and for unclarity. And given that the function of the standard of proof is to provide a decision rule for making a crucial decision, I've long thought that it would be nice if we could make it more precise, if we could clean it up, and not just making it more precise, if we could make it such that it captured our beliefs and intuitions as citizens about the respective costs of the two kinds of errors that can occur. So for a long time, I tried to fashion clearer versions of what a reasonable standard of proof would be. Legal systems on the whole neither undertake research to find out what the costs of the respective harms are, nor to find out whether existing rules of their legal system are generating a distribution of errors between false positives and false negatives that accords with the respective costs of false convictions and false acquittals. I don't want to dwell today on the absurdity of designing a legal system, and I do mean the absurdity of designing a legal system that utterly lacks machinery to identify its mistakes, that lacks machinery to learn from those mistakes about how it must reform its existing rules so as to reduce the harms done by criminal trials. It is all but self-evident that legal systems as they now stand are bogus, that is, illegitimate engines of inquiry. They lack both the tools and the critical disposition to learn from their mistakes. And it's a key feature of any honest empirical system of inquiry that it, A, is likely to make mistakes, B, has machinery to identify the mistakes it makes, and C, can ascertain what it was that caused the mistake and remedy that feature. Unfortunately, however, the law is not that way. But that's not the theme I want to dwell on principally today. What I want to do instead is to direct our attention to an effort to introduce a certain degree of rationality into the legal system by bringing the tools of decision theory and cost-benefit analysis to bear on how to fix a standard of proof that will produce a ratio of errors that stands up to scrutiny. That is, a ratio of errors that genuinely reflects our views about the respective costs of the two errors. Starting in the middle of the 20th century, efforts were made by decision theorists to try to do just that. I refer, of course, to the writing of scholars like Tribe and Kaplan, who sought to define a standard of proof grounded in a decision theoretic framework. Doubtless, everyone here is familiar with those efforts. But just to remind you, I will trigger your memory by pointing out that Kaplan's rule for a rational standard of proof is given as a standard of proof being 1 over 1 plus the ratio of the costs of the two errors. That was proposed in 1967. 3 years later, Lawrence Tribe, the famous constitutional lawyer in the United States, propounded a more subtle formula than Kaplan's, one that took into account both the utilities of true outcomes, which Kaplan had ignored, and the disutilities of erroneous outcomes. So what this reads as saying is that the standard of proof, if rational, is one divided by, and then in the denominator we have one plus the utilities of true acquittals minus the utilities of false acquittals divided by the utility of true convictions minus false acquittals divided by the utility of true acquittals minus the utility of false convictions. When I encountered this work, I thought it was very exciting, not least because it offered not only a potentially clear version of the standard of proof, but much more importantly, because it offered a version of the standard of proof that, if implemented, would indeed produce errors in the ratios that reflected our underlying assessment of the respective costs of those errors. Both Kaplan and Tribe left unsettled the question as to what the costs of these utilities should be. That's understandable, since their proposal was essentially an a priori derivation of a formula. They left to others the task of figuring out what values to plug into the respective definitions. What is the utility of a true acquittal? What is the disutility of a false conviction? Unfortunately, however, very few people have picked up on the possibility of using formulae like these for re-expressing the standard of proof in this country or that country or wherever it might be. Legal theorists, including those often favorably disposed to the proposals of Tribe and Kaplan, have scarcely bothered to do any research into the utilities and disutilities of the four possible outcomes. Deontologists don't want to touch the subject since they have no conceptual machinery for assigning values to the various outcomes. At best, they can do an ordinal ordering of them, which doesn't give us utilities. That enables them to say that a false positive is worse than a false negative, but they have never, never told us how much the former is worse than the latter. Those of us more inclined to consequentialist theories of punishment have made some stabs at estimating the respective harms or costs of false acquittals and false convictions, but this remains a nascent area of research. What I want to show today, however, is that a decision theoretic approach to defining an acceptable and efficient standard of proof, as promising as it looked a few years ago, is for the moment doomed. Not because the formula are wrongly derived, nor because there are no data that would allow us to figure out what the respective costs of the two errors would be, but because these two formulae don't reckon with the fact, a fundamental fact about the criminal rules of procedure in virtually every legal system in the world. And it's that fact that I want to bring to your attention today and to explore what alternatives are left to those of us minded to try to induce some degree of rationality and non-arbitrariness into the specific task of setting the height of the standard of proof and the general task of transforming law into what it desperately needs to be, a legitimate form of empirical inquiry. Before we get to the critique I will offer and the proof that the Kaplan-Tribe approach will not work, right, it would be helpful to remind ourselves that the principal function of a standard of proof is to distribute errors in accord with an informed consensus about the respective costs or harms of false positives and false negatives. The standard of proof is not and never has been intended as an error-reducing mechanism. It's an error-distributing mechanism, okay? In theory, we are prone to leave error reduction to other rules of evidence, such as the rule of relevance, or the ability of both parties to cross-examine eyewitnesses and experts. Instead, the standard of proof aims not to reduce errors, but to shift the errors in a direction that reflects their respective costs. My argument today will be that as tempting as the Kaplan-Tribe route is intellectually, its implementation will certainly not produce a distribution of errors that reflects our values. There is one simple reason why not. It is that in most legal systems, and most egregiously so in the American legal system, the rules of evidence and procedure are replete with rules that give asymmetric probatory advantages to the criminal defendant. Every such advantage-conferring rule has an impact on the distribution of errors, regardless of what the official standard of proof is. If we have a rule of evidence that tells us that a certain piece of relevant evidence is to be excluded, perhaps because it was illegally seized, okay, the exclusion of that evidence imposes an additional burden on the prosecutor to succeed, if he's going to succeed, in establishing the guilt. Because evidence relevant to the guilt or innocence of the defendant has been excluded by the procedural rule. The impact of rules like that is that there will be fewer convictions. And that means not only fewer false convictions, but significantly fewer true convictions, okay? That is a way in which the distribution of errors is impacted by a procedural rule. Okay, every rule that gives a probative advantage to the defendant increases the likelihood of false acquittals and true acquittals alike. Adopting a phrase I once learned from my friend Ron Allen, who's here today, I call these rules burden enhancers. They add to the probative difficulties faced by the prosecutor, whatever the standard of proof is. Ideally, the rules of evidence and procedure should be truth-conducive rules, not truth-thwarting or frustrating rules. To achieve that end, they have to be party-neutral and symmetric. In the U.S., however, as we'll see shortly, there are substantially more than 40 commonly used rules of procedure which are burden-enhancing, which make proof of guilt more difficult than it would be if our concern were chiefly with finding out the truth. They reduce accuracy in verdicts while making false positives less likely than they would be if the rules were epistemically robust and party neutral. In my remarks today, I will remind you of a few of those more notorious burden enhancers and perhaps some others that you haven't ever considered as having a burden-altering impact. Once we have those examples before us, I will explain why the fact that burden changers are abundant means there can be no standard of proof, no matter how clearly defined, that will yield the harvest of false positives and false negatives that we might have expected from that standard. Let's consider a few examples. There is the character evidence rule, for instance. That's the middle rule on this list. These are all rules from American criminal procedural law. If the defendant does not want character evidence about his own character presented at trial, he simply makes it clear that it cannot be presented, and he is given by the rules the right to exclude all character evidence about his prior behavior, if he wants to exercise that option. If, on the other hand, he thinks he has a good character and he'd like to bring that character evidence into the trial, he's also allowed to do that. Okay? So what you have is a situation where the courts acknowledge the relevance of character evidence. If they didn't acknowledge that, they would not allow the defendant to present and introduce his own character evidence. But having acknowledged the relevance of that, they also give the defendant control over whether evidence of his prior bad acts or prior good acts will or will not be admitted. It's very clear that this rule is asymmetric in its consequences. The prosecutor has no control over whether character evidence will or will not be admitted. It's completely under the thumb of the defendant. Or consider another example. Since the 1970s in the United States, it has been a fundamental rule that defendants have the right not to testify at trial. They've long had that right, but the new version of that right is that not only are they under no obligation to testify, but jurors are to be firmly instructed that they are to draw no adverse inferences from the refusal of the defendant to offer testimony. Okay. This was an interpretation imposed by the Supreme Court in a series of four famous rulings in the 1970s. It's often known as the Griffin Rule. The jury is told the defendant has not said anything in his defense, but you mustn't infer that he doesn't have anything to say simply because he didn't say it. Okay. Here is another example of a rule where arguably relevant inferences that would in the past have been drawn by jurors from the silence of a defendant, namely, if this defendant didn't say anything in his defense, that probably means he doesn't have anything to say in his defense. That inference is now verboten. You cannot use it. At least you're told by the judge you cannot use it. Whether jurors actually continue to do what they used to do, nobody quite knows. But the motive here, interestingly, is to protect the innocent defendant who doesn't want to testify. Because the Supreme Court says maybe he feels shy. Okay. Well, note that this rule does more to protect the guilty defendant than it does to protect the innocent defendant, and patently makes a dramatic impact on the distribution of errors in ways that, in my view, are totally unacceptable. Another example, there's the question of the jury selection, which in a sort of common law world is a very important question. Both parties, that is the prosecution and the defense, are given what are called peremptory challenges. Before the jurors are selected, counsel interview the jurors, ask them questions. And in some cases, jurors are eliminated because of the answers they gave. That's called elimination for cause. Okay. Both parties, the prosecution and the defense, can solicit the elimination of a certain prospective witness if they can give a cause, a reason why they suspect that witness will not function well. Maybe he's biased or prejudiced or whatever it might be. However, there are also what are called peremptory challenges, where one party or the other says, I don't like this prospective witness, and so I want him scratched from the list, but I'm not going to give you any reason that would justify eliminating this witness. I'm just telling you, I don't want him there. Both sides have the right to use this peremptory rule. But in most states in the United States, the defendant is given a significantly longer list of jurors that he can exclude without cause than the prosecution has. Once again, an intriguing, error-shifting result, because it means that the defendant has more to say about the construction of the jury than the prosecution does. That is a patently asymmetric rule. One last example, and then we'll move on to try and draw some conclusions. You all know what the discovery rule is. Basically, it involves the idea that evidence should be shared between both parties prior to a trial so that neither party can spring a surprise on the other party. There's powerful epistemological arguments in favor of the rule of discovery. It does mean, and after all, truth is more likely to emerge if it emerges from a discussion in which both parties are aware of the evidence in advance and have prepared themselves to cross-examine the witnesses who will be presented or to challenge the evidence that's being presented. In the United States, however, the discovery rule has the following feature. It is not automatic in every trial. It falls to the defendant to decide whether discovery will take place. If he wants to know what information, what evidence the prosecution is being presented, he can demand to know it. But if he, the defendant, has a surprise witness that he wants to spring, and he doesn't want the prosecution to know in advance that this witness is going to be called, then procedural law in the United States gives the defendant the right to decide whether discovery will occur in a trial. The prosecution has no say about whether discovery will occur, right? Either the defendant asks for it, and then both parties have to show the other party what evidence they've got, or the defendant said, no, I don't want any discovery in this trial, right? And that will be the view that prevails. These burden enhancers, and as I said, I've got 35 others besides the ones I've mentioned, they not only have an impact on the outcome of many criminal trials, but their very existence almost certainly influences the plea bargains that are struck by prosecutors and confessing parties. It doesn't require much perspicacity or subtlety to realize that if several of the rules, burden-enhancing rules, are in place in any given criminal case, then the likelihood of conviction of a guilty person will be significantly lower than it would have been if the rules were, as decision theory supposes, producing data that were epistemically appropriate, and giving jury instructions that encouraged jurors to draw appropriate inferences from the data they had seen and heard. Whether you incline to the view that these burden enhancers that I've mentioned simply embody the rights of defendants, or the more realistic view that these are the conventions invented by appellate courts, panicked by the fear that from time to time a false conviction might occur, it has to be acknowledged that the continued existence of these burden enhancers will lead to an error profile or a run of trials that decision theory would lead us, different from what decision theory would lead us to expect. Because every one of these advantage-granting rules alters the distribution of error in the defendant's favor, on top of the role of the standard of proof in altering the distribution of errors. Given all that, we have to ask, can we put a viable standard of proof in place? I think we can. I believe there are remedies for doing it. One remedy, though not the only one, would be to say that burden-enhancing rules have no legitimate role in procedural law. That what the rules of evidence should be doing is promoting, making it likely that errors are not going to occur in abundance. And that if errors do occur, they don't occur just to favor the defendant or just to favor the prosecution. I will cut this short because I know my time is just about to run out. I will mention one other point that it seems to me underscores the importance of getting clear about the standard of proof. All of these are various rules I have, yes. But I won't bore you with those. I'd like you to contemplate this table for a minute and what it signifies. It's based on a detailed study I've done over the last 2 years of about 700,000 trials in the United States, or cases in the United States, of individuals being arrested for violent crimes. Okay? What we now have a very good idea of is how their apparent guilt is distributed. Along the bottom line here, we have apparent guilt going from 0.5 to 1. Okay? We know how many of these people are convicted. What proportion are convicted? We can use what we know about the proportion who are convicted in order to construct two distributions. The distribution with dashed lines is the distribution of apparent guilt on the part of those people who were actually innocent. You'll see it clusters at about 0.75. That's the apparent guilt. On the other hand, the apparent guilt of the guilty is heavily clustered at the right-hand end of the scale. We know that the standard of proof falls somewhere in the range between roughly 0.85 and 0.9. Now, the point I want to draw to your attention is, look at the ratio of difference between the number of guilty people and the number of innocent people above the standard of proof. How do we know that it's there? Well, I don't have the time to go into the details now, but if you want to ask a question, I can. What we do know is this, that within the range defined by the standard of proof in the United States, the frequency of false convictions is 3%. Okay? That means, obviously, that there are about 32 guilty people, genuinely, truly guilty people, for every truly innocent person who end up with having an apparent guilt at or above the standard of proof. That's what having a 3% false conviction rate entails. You've got a 30-to-1 ratio of guilty, truly guilty people to truly innocent people among those whose Guilt falls above the standard of proof. But now ask yourself, well, what about moving just, looking just below the standard of proof? There you have a situation where, as you can see from these curves, it remains true that there's a relatively high ratio of truly guilty to truly innocent people. And that relatively high ratio is maintained all the way down to about 85%. Put it differently, in the region close to the standard of proof, but below the standard of proof, we are acquitting roughly 25 guilty people for every innocent person we are acquitting. Okay? I'll repeat that. We're acquitting 25 guilty people for every truly innocent person that we're acquitting in the region just below the existing standard of proof. Now, you have to ask yourself, is that a ratio we could think about living with? Not even Blackstone thought that a ratio of 25 to 1 was acceptable. He was thinking about a 10 to 1 ratio. His view was that we need to set a standard of proof in approximately the place where we're going to have 10 false acquittals for every false conviction. But in fact, the way the American standard of proof goes, with its 3% false conviction rate, what it's doing is producing about 25 falsely convicted, falsely acquitted guilty people for every single innocent person that it saves from conviction. I don't think anybody in their right mind would believe that that ratio reflects our views about the respective costs of the two. And that takes me really to the end of the remarks that I wanted to make, namely that we've got to do something about burden enhancers, because even very small alterations in the standard of proof in terms of moving it slightly lower than it is or slightly higher than it is will have profound ramifications for the distribution of errors, precisely because of this issue of there being vastly more truly guilty people in the vicinity of apparent guilt of the standard of proof than there will be innocent persons. I leave it at that.
En la vida hay muchos placeres, pero probablemente uno de los principales placeres científicos que uno puede darse es escuchar una conferencia como la que acabamos de ver. Hacía muchísimo tiempo que no escuchaba a alguien viviendo lo que decía y expresándolo con tal convicción, ¿no? Y con tal placer, transmitiendo pues lo que ha sido el fruto de su investigación. De verdad, muchísimas gracias tanto por el fondo como por la forma de la conferencia. Bien, ahora tenemos un tiempo de debate razonablemente extendido, con lo cual, si alguien quiere tomar la palabra.
I would have a question, because it was really fascinating, thank you very much. But I cannot understand exactly how you found out the error. I mean, you said there is a, yeah, exactly. Because you see on the appeals, so you see, you look at the reformed decisions or whatever, because we have no, I think, we are not sure of anything. I mean, how can you, I mean, the reasonment is perfect. But I can't understand exactly how you can verify the correctness of. Thank you.
Can you hear me in the back?
It's a perfectly legitimate question, and it's an issue that has caused generations of lawyers and judges to scratch their heads, you know? Unfortunately, we live in a system where, until very recently, we haven't had any idea either what the rate of false convictions was or what the rate of false acquittals was. And that's a mess to be in if you're trying to promote an institution that's supposed to generate confidence on the part of the public.
and that is making extremely important decisions. But to address your question in particular, there have now been, between England and the US, a total of 17 studies of false convictions. Some of these studies depend on exonerations that emerged. But the ones that are really compelling, and where I think they warrant, because they're of the good design of these tests, they depend on DNA determinations. They examine cases, especially cases of a rape and murder, where there is or can be found DNA evidence. What these studies do is focus first on people who were convicted of murder or rape when DNA was not an admissible form of evidence. We're talking about the 1980s. In the early 1990s, in both England and in the United States, DNA came widely available, and it is an extremely reliable indicator, as all of you know. In some of these research studies that have been done, particularly one by Michael Reisinger, done by the Innocence Project near New York City, he has looked at a large number of cases, indeed virtually all of the cases, in the New York, New Jersey region in the 1980s, cases decided when there was no DNA evidence available, has recollected DNA evidence for all of those cases and compared it with the DNA of the person who is now in prison having been convicted for a crime. And the figure that Reisinger comes up with routinely is in the range of about 2.9% to 3.4%, okay? The same figure is emerging from DNA studies that have been done by Innocence Projects in various other parts of the country. The use of DNA and the fact that there was a transition from no DNA availability to DNA availability suddenly gave the legal community epistemic access after the fact to how many times did cases fail, were people who were innocent convicted of serious crimes, right? So the 3% figure is the average that comes out of 18 different studies that have been done. Okay. No one, I think, believes it to be significantly higher than that. There are no studies that show it to be. The highest one is one coming out of England at about 4.7%. Okay. Well, if you have 18 studies, not all of which, but most of which are well designed and clearly articulated, all of which produce an error rate, a false conviction rate, in the range of 2 to 5, which is where a range in which every one of these 18 studies falls, it seems reasonable to have some degree of confidence that the legal system, in fact, is not making very many erroneous convictions. Nothing like what, say, Blackstone thought, where he thought maybe it was 1 in 10, right? We've got a legal system, of course, that varies, a pattern that varies from one country to another. What is the false conviction rate in Spain or in Mexico? I don't know. But we know now how to find it out. There are ways of doing this that give us a fairly high degree of confidence that about the numbers that we're coming up with. More complicated is the issue of how to determine what the frequency of false acquittals are. Because almost nobody's interested in studying that question. Right? You don't get newspaper headlines of the sort you get if you can show that somebody who was convicted, right, was really innocent. I mean, that will make the front page of the paper. But if you could somehow show that somebody who was acquitted is guilty, who cares? It just isn't a problem that has garnered the attention of the legal community very much. The book that I'm currently working on is an attempt to put together such research as we now know about with respect to the frequency of false acquittals. And once we know the answer to those two questions, then we can ask, finally, what I think is the most important one, namely, it's the distribution of errors that prevails in a particular legal system, one that is coherent with and corresponds to the values of that system. If it is not, then adjustments have to be made in the procedural rules. If it does correspond to social values, then we can pat ourselves on the back and say, yes, we've got the right standard of proof, even though nobody knows how to define it.
There are some other questions. Larry, what is the, one might think that this is really a small point at which to stick. Can you not hear me? One might think it's a small point at which to stick. In a world of plea bargaining, we have very few criminal trials in the United States. Most cases are resolved.
90% by plea bargaining.
At least 90% by plea bargaining. And as many of you know, lots of defendants who believe that they are innocent don't feel that they can take the risk of going to trial because there's an asymmetric penalty involved. Namely, if they are wrong about the fact that they would be acquitted, they will suffer a sentence much higher than they can bargain to. So in a world of plea bargaining, I'm not sure what all this hand-wringing is about. Or put it another way, if one were to go down the route that you suggest, one at least should also consider the asymmetry of the plea bargaining process.
Thank you for the question. I think I'm 50% in agreement with it. My focus, as I indicated briefly in my remarks, has been chiefly on the ways in which violent crimes are handled. There, the 90% figure you cite, which is certainly true as a generalization about American trials ending up in plea bargains rather than going before a jury, in the case of violent crimes, it tends to be more like 60% being plea bargained rather than 90%. And the more serious the charge becomes, murder and rape, for instance, a much higher proportion go to trial. But that is not the important part of my response to your observation, because I completely grant that an awful lot of the convictions that emerge, even for violent crimes, are the result of elaborate plea bargain processes. My immediate fallback position, however, with respect to saying that isn't overly troubling, is that in the various projects that have been done, particularly coming out of the so-called innocence projects, right, they have been willing to take on both people who were convicted by plea bargains and people who were convicted either by bench trials or jury trials. And intriguingly, in every one of the studies that includes plea bargain convictions and jury trial convictions, what do they find? They find a higher error rate among jury convictions than they do among plea bargains. That is to say, with juries, it tends to be about 3.5% if you just look at jury trials. With plea bargains, according to the studies that have been done, the false conviction rate is coming in at about 1.7%. Which I know is counterintuitive, because the prevailing conventional wisdom in the English-speaking world about plea bargains is, oh, well, there is this incentive structure which is apt to lead to a situation in which genuinely innocent people, for fear of possibly being convicted and having to pay the price of that, decide to opt for a plea bargain that maybe involves only a couple of years in jail. But as plausible as that account is, right, the numbers, as near as I can tell, don't bear out at all the claim that a higher proportion of people who are convicted by plea bargains are indeed innocent people than the people who are convicted by jury trial. Ron.
Do I need to speak to a microphone or not? I don't, seems kind of pointless.
It depends on.
Yeah, I think it's kind of pointless.
Hi. Hi, everybody. I'm Ron Allen. I'll be talking to you later today about actually some of these things. So I'm not going to talk about the things that I'm going to talk about later on. But
this man, by the way, is the father of Bergman, the enhancer and Bergman producer.
C'est moi, so to speak. The difficulty I have with this entire range of analysis, and you're fully aware of this, is it doesn't take into account the dynamic dynamic nature of the legal system. That
we can hear you, but the microphone doesn't work.
Can you hear me now?
It.
All right, so let me back up. The difficulty I have, and I just mean it's a difficulty, I don't mean anything other than that, is it's not taking into account the dynamic nature of the legal system and the environment in which the legal system operates. It's analyzing these things as though they were static, as though you had a variable that you could change, and by changing that variable, you can predict the outcome like a faucet. You know, you turn the faucet, you get more water. That's not what I would predict. What I would predict is that whatever you embodying you as the decision maker, the king maker, whatever you did to these numbers and whatever change you imported into the system would be met with a dynamic response by the participants. And as a result, it's completely unpredictable what the result would be of any fiddling with these kinds of formal standards. So the general point here is that the systems that you're dealing with are not static. They're dynamic. This is a general problem for legal scholarship, in my opinion, and actually I'll be talking a little bit about that later today, at least indirectly. But it certainly is the case here. I mean, you have no idea how prosecutors will change their selection criteria, how defendants will respond, and what kind of dynamics will develop. That's the difficulty. So I think it's a very interesting analysis, but the actual consequences, since you're a consequentialist, it seems to me are empirical, that have to take into account the dynamic nature of the system.
Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah. It seems to me there is a degree of predictability here that one can count on with respect to what I've been calling and what you originally called burden enhancing rules and their elimination. For instance, if one were to say that discovery takes place in general, in all trials, okay, and not leave it to the choice of the defendant to do that, to make the decision as to whether discovery applies, it seems to me, an unproblematic prediction to make that if there is a broad discovery rule that is not asymmetric, we're going to see a shift in the frequency of false acquittals, okay? But more importantly than that, and here I think I do try to take into account your highly dynamic picture of how these parameters change, is this. When I say that what we've learned is that about 3% of those convicted in serious trials in the United States are innocent people, okay? When we say that, that doesn't mean that that's the figure that's going to obtain through time, because the procedures, the rules, the politics, the attitude of jurors, things like that, change through time. What it seems to me is necessary, or at least desirable, if we're going to have a legal system that is sensitive to these changes, we've got to be constantly collecting anew data about what has been the error profile of trials in the last N years. We're in, say, 3 or 5 or what have you. We've got to be monitoring that in exactly the same way that empirical researchers monitor how error rates change. If you adopt a new form of testing for acids, for instance, in the laboratory, right, you're going to have a different error profile for that, a different set of false positives and false negatives than if you use an older form of testing for acidity, okay? But it's possible to keep monitoring that, provided we keep looking over our own shoulders and saying, okay, how many mistakes were made in this type of trial at that time. How many mistakes are now being made? Right? Until we know those kinds of things, the situation is hopeless. But you're dead right, I think, that no matter what we do, as long as we're making any changes in the legal system, there will be some unanticipated consequences. But the way to figure out what those were is not to anticipate them in advance so much as to introduce a change in procedural law, compare the data before that change with the data after that change, and then to see, well, what does seem to have been the impact of that kind of, that particular change.
I have another question, unless somebody else does. Is there time for me to ask?
Yes, we just have 5 minutes, but so, go ahead.
I mean, I agree with your general approach, but one has to be really, really careful about the model. For example, you say that there's no discovery from criminal defendants. This is the rhetorical position that you can find written else, you know, throughout the world, actually. Turns out it's false. Defendants can't litigate an alibi unless it's disclosed in advance. So you cannot have a surprise witness who comes out of nowhere that puts him in Timbuktu at the time of the crime. A defendant has to disclose in advance if he intends to, a criminal defendant, litigate mental conditions. Defendants have to disclose in advance all experts that they intend to call at trial. Now there,
but they don't have to reveal what their testimony is going to be.
No, that's false. They do. An expert, they do. It is the case they don't have to disclose the contents of their own minds. Right. That's right. And I'm not, by the way, I want to be clear. I'm not disagreeing with the major thrust of the point that you're making. As you know, from Larry and I go back a long way, and we've had conversations about this a long time. It's just that you have to be careful. I mean, there is a distribution of, I call them relative shifts in the burden of persuasion, that go back and forth. And you just need to be careful that the model maps onto to reality, and then you have to start thinking about the dynamic nature of these events.
Yeah, I agree. So, that's it?
Okay.
I have a...
I don't know. There's another question there.
Hi. So I like very much what you said, that the standard of proof is not a mechanism for reducing error, but it's a mechanism for distributing error. And I liked it partly because that's not typically how lawyers think, right? But I wonder then whether they should always think this way in the following sense, and then whether there is another asymmetry that we should take care of. That is, in order to see the standard of proof as a way of distributing errors, you need to have a global picture of what's going on at trials, right? And that's exactly what you're doing. So you're looking at general outcomes of trials, and you want a ratio of false acquittals and true acquittals and everything else. But clearly, that's not the only thing that we are justifying through the legal system and through the rules of procedure, right? We are justifying to person A, you're going to jail, or we're justifying to victim B or to the people in that legal system, X, whatever, we're letting him or her go because, you know, we can't reach the standard of proof that it's justified. So I wonder whether the other asymmetry is that we need both kinds of justification that clearly go in different directions. One is a justification that you're aiming at. What are the general good consequences overall in following one rule or another for the standard of proof? But the other one is simply the justification to the individual person that it's going to jail. And, you know, it's not easy to aggregate the individual justification to the big justification at the end, right? And it's not clear that simply doing the costs depend how you define the costs, right? But we need a theory of justice that does the aggregating. And I wonder whether we have that yet.
I don't think it's difficult to figure out the cost. The cost will double.
Do you hear them?
Yeah, but the question is not just about figuring out the cost. It's really about two ways of justifying, two things that need justifying. We need the individual justification, I guess, I assume. I mean, if I were under trial. I would want a justification to me. I don't want to be justified. You know, I don't want to go to jail because, you know, it will produce good consequences overall. So, you know, you're good to go. No, I want a justification to me. You know, that you are convinced, that the judge is convinced that I'm guilty. And
yes, and
but
he, okay.
Clearly, as a citizen, I also would like a justification that it makes sense to have that standard of proof. So I'm not saying that I don't want the kind of justification that you're aiming at. But the point, it's not the only one. There is the other justification to the individual being under trial.
I don't understand that, the latter case. Somebody says, I was just convicted of armed robbery, and I didn't do it, and I'm... You know, this was unfair, this was unjust. The response that I assume the state would offer is, look, we had several eyewitnesses who appeared to be reliable, who claimed to have seen you in the act of committing this robbery. You had, your fingerprints were found on the weapon. There would be a rehearsal of the evidence that had been reviewed, and at the same time, an indication that the evidence in aggregate appeared more than sufficient to satisfy the currently prevailing standard of proof. And therefore, you know, you're going to have to suffer the punishment unless you can prove after the fact, through exoneration, that you didn't actually do it after all. I mean, I think it's really important that we keep in mind that at least in most countries, there is the exoneration option open, particularly provided that the convicted person who claims to be innocent can present new, pertinent, genuinely relevant evidence to his hypothesis that he did not do it. But I don't know beyond that, what are we supposed to agonize over the fact that, well, goodness, you know, a few innocent people, no matter how high we set the standard of proof, a few innocent people are going to end up in jail when they don't deserve it? Well, that's one of the sad consequences of the nature of any decision-making process, right? And I think provided we can justify the decision-making process, providing we can show that the standard does indeed reflect society's views about the respective costs of these two errors, then it's a matter of simply saying, we're sorry, Mr. Innocent, that it went this way. Go to an exoneration hearing and get yourself out of jail if you can. But we have to accept the fact that there will be, from time to time, both erroneous convictions and erroneous acquittals, because, you know, ever since Hume, we've known that if you're trying to reconstruct historical events, you cannot have certainty about them. And there is no certainty to be had in a trial, any more than there is certainty to be had in medical research or the research of chemists or physicists or pollsters or whatever, what have you. One does the best one can, acknowledges that one may be mistaken. I don't know if that answers, deals with your worries or not.
Okay, thank you very much for all the questions. Thank you very much, Mr. Loden. Acabamos aquí. Gracias.